This is case number 76422, Gavin and Min Cox versus Copperfield et al. I have attorneys here. I'm not sure if everybody's here on my list. We have Heather Harris, Brian Harris, Christian Griffin, and Benedict Morelli for the appellants, Perry Follick for the appellants, Elaine Fresh for the respondents, Jerry Popovich for respondents, Howard Russell for the respondents, and Dan Polzenberg for respondents as well. So I see the screen, so I think we have not everybody there, but many of those people here. Now, I understand for the respondents, there's going to be a division of time on the thing. Mr. Polzenberg, may I ask you, since I know you the best, can you tell us what the division of time is on for the respondents?
Certainly, Your Honor.
I'm going to go first. I'm going to take 10 minutes, and I'm going to be arguing the sub rosa video and closing arguments. Ms. Fresh is going to go next. She's probably going to go about 5 minutes and talk about the causation issue. Howard and Jerry are going to bat clean up and split the rest of the time.
Okay.
And of course, if you're more interested in one issue versus another, if you're interested in a later issue, let me know, and I will wrap up earlier and give my co-counsel more time.
Okay, thank you. And for benefit of counsel, I know we have it for 40 minutes. We might go a little bit longer. Lots of issues, lots of very interesting issues here. So we'll see how many questions the court has, and we don't want to allow counsel reasonable time for everybody to make their arguments here today. So at this time, we'll proceed with the appellant. And then, Ms. Harris, are you going to proceed with the argument on behalf of the appellants?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you, and good morning. I'd like to reserve a few minutes for a rebuttal, if that's possible.
How many minutes? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
5 minutes for rebuttal. Please.
5 minutes, okay. You may proceed, go ahead.
Good morning, may it please the court?
Before we proceed, I apologize. We have Chief Justice Pickering is filling in for Justice Silver. Justice Silver participated in this case as a member of the Court of Appeals, so she had to recuse. So the Chief will fill in for her. Justice Stiglitz is in Carson City in her chambers, and then Chief Justice Pickering and myself are here in Las Vegas in the courtroom. That being said, Mr. Sorry for interrupting you. You may go ahead and proceed.
No problem. And I appreciate everyone being here this morning. Thank you very much, and good morning. The matter before you today involves a lengthy trial and a number of errors. The trial lasted several weeks. Any of these errors in and of themselves are grounds for reversal and remand. We brought before you the ones that we feel are the most significant, the ones that are most significantly detrimental and created significant harm to the plaintiff appellants. It made it impossible, given them each of these errors in and of themselves, but particularly the cumulative effect of these errors. When you put them together one by one on top of another, the deck was truly stacked against plaintiff appellants, and it made it impossible for them to receive a fair trial or a just verdict. The first, and what I believe to be one of the more significant issues in this case, was the improper admission of the sub rosa video. It's very important to note that this case was bifurcated. The trial was bifurcated at the request of defendants. Plaintiffs objected to that bifurcation. We didn't want it. There was argument. The court ultimately ruled in favor of defendants and decided that liability would be tried separately from damages. Therefore, in this portion of the case, we were only discussing liability. Plaintiffs were prevented from bringing forth any evidence whatsoever regarding damages, injury, ailments, his abilities, his deficits, of which he has many, relevant to this case. That being said, there was a particular question that was brought up only on cross-examination one time, and it was a rather innocuous-seeming question at the time, almost offhanded. seeming like an afterthought, asking Mr. Cox whether, when he's outside of the presence of the jury, if he walks with assistance. And he said yes, which was an honest answer. What didn't make sense at the time is that it didn't really seem to be a question connected with any other thing. It was a single question. It was a vague question. It was an ambiguous question. It didn't really have any basis in connection with anything else. It just sort of was a question, right? Like, well, do you walk like this when you're outside? And he said yes. And that was that.
Well, wasn't he asked whether he had asked the bailiff or the marshal for assistance in walking up? Didn't the marshal or somebody assist him walking from his counsel table to the witness stand?
The marshal did assist him. You are correct, Your Honor. However, I don't believe he was asked any questions about that. He was asked a single question, whether he walks outside of court with assistance. And that was the single question. My understanding is that he was offered assistance from the marshal in the beginning of the trial, which he accepted. It wasn't a question or an ongoing line of questioning. Defendants had every opportunity to ask him those questions, I suppose, if they wanted to, but they chose not to. It was a single question that was only brought up on cross-examination. None of these lines of questions were brought up on direct, and I think that that's very important when you consider evidentiary law in Nevada. The problem here is that in a liability portion of this trial, his abilities to walk assisted or unassisted should have no relevance whatsoever. They should not be brought in. It shouldn't be discussed. It shouldn't be a piece of evidence that is important to this portion of the trial. Specifically, it's completely collateral to the issues at hand. And by allowing this video, which was created, produced, and edited by defendants, to be brought forth, showing him walking at times without assistance, and then juxtaposing that with his walking with assistance in the courtroom, without explanation and without giving plaintiffs an equal opportunity to explain why there were medical reasons or perhaps mental or physical reasons why he may need additional assistance or want additional assistance in the courtroom, it put plaintiffs at a severe disadvantage. It branded plaintiffs.
Excuse me. Yes. The district court did not rule that you could not ask the plaintiff why he was walking on the arm of the marshal, did it?
Plaintiffs were given an opportunity to recall Mr. Cox after direct, after cross, and after this video had already been provided to the plaintiffs.
Strictly true that he didn't have the opportunity to explain, for example, the courtroom is terrifying to me and I want a steady arm at my side. He could have been called to say something like that.
Your Honor, he could have been called. We made a strategic decision at the time that he was already maligned in the eyes of the jury, and it would have been impossible for him to overcome the detriment that had been brought to him by the video. That by him coming forth after already having been branded a liar and saying, well, I had a reason for doing that, already he has been shown to be dishonest in the eyes of the jury, and him coming forth and speaking on his own behalf would have not done anything to help his particular cause and could have very well harmed it given his situation with his medical needs.
But I wanted to
ask you a question. I'm sorry, Your Honor, please go ahead.
Justice Stiglitz?
I just want to be clear. When the colloquy, and it's in 13J3063, they asked about holding the marshal's arm, They asked about whether he requested assistance, to which he said no. They asked if his attorney requested assistance, to which he said no, at which time, as I understand, Cox made an objection, and it was a relevance objection for the most part because of the liability issue. And then Backstage's lawyer came back and said it has to do with credibility. And on that basis, the court overruled the relevancy objection. And so they were the first one. Then the next question is, do you get assistance when you're downstairs at the courthouse? Is that kind of the correct sequence?
Yes, Your Honor is correct in that regard.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry.
So given...
You may proceed. Go ahead, Ms. Harrison.
Thank you very much. And that actually brings me to another point. He did not ask for assistance. He did not request assistance. Counsel didn't request assistance. However, once the video was produced, it became a bell that could not be unrung. It was a video that attempted to show him acting a certain way when it was not intended to... It was not intended to be such, and he should not have been allowed to have been presented, the defendant should not have been allowed to have presented that video regarding activities that were not testimony on the stand. He did not testify regarding his abilities or his inabilities. He did not bring these issues into question. These issues were only brought into question because of the single question that was asked by Mr. Popovich. In fact, because this was the liability portion, we were never allowed to bring any of these other issues into question. Had we been allowed to...
Wasn't there testimony allowed about his brain injury and how that may have affected his demeanor or testimony?
There was not... evidence allowed. There was a court instruction. The district court instructed the jury that he did have an alleged brain injury and that the court or that the jurors could consider that brain injury when they were contemplating his testimony.
Thank you.
It was not evidence. There was no evidence ever produced. There was no evidence ever presented. We were not allowed to present any medical testimony. We were not allowed to present any documents. We were not allowed to produce any witnesses related to his medical condition at all.
Okay. Ms. Harrison, in the interest of time, could I ask you about a couple other issues in the case as well?
Absolutely.
I think we understand your position on the video. Let's go to the comparative negligence. You argue that it was a mistake for the court to instruct the jury on comparative negligence. My question is, it's a slip and fall case under NRS 41.141. Isn't the court required to instruct on comparative negligence if there would be any evidence to suggest that there may have been negligence on the part of Mr. Cox?
Your Honor is correct if there is evidence. However, there was not evidence that was actually presented in this case. Slipping and tripping, by definition, are involuntary acts. In order for there to be evidence of contributory negligence or comparative fault, you would have to have some evidence that Mr. Cox did something affirmatively, understood the action he was taking, and did it anyway. If he went rogue or went outside of the directives that were given by Mr. Copperfield or MGM or Backstage, if he had done something outside of the scope of what they had laid out, perhaps that would have met, but there was zero evidence given that he did anything wrong. There was no witness testimony, including Mr. Habersack, Mr. Copperfield himself. Mr. Habersack was a 30B6 witness who was presented by MGM. He was their witness who said he did not know of anything that Mr. Cox did wrong. Mr. Copperfield, similarly, could not find anything that Mr. Cox did wrong. He followed the directions. He had no idea where he was going. He had no idea what was before him. He trusted that MGM, and Copperfield, who had complete control of the circumstances, complete control of the scene, complete control of the route, who had set up everything with regard to the illusion, and which, as we've discussed, had been widely protected so that there was no way that somebody could have known ahead of time what even to encounter, how could he have engaged in some known risk? He wasn't doing anything outside of what he was asked to do in a reasonable way. He wasn't taking any unreasonable action. If he had taken an unreasonable action, or there was evidence that he had taken an unreasonable action, I suppose I could see where that instruction would be required. However, there was no evidence whatsoever that he had taken an unreasonable action. And in fact, the court had discussed this during an assumption of the risk argument that was made pre-trial, and the court had denied defense requests to be able to make that argument. And this, in our view, was an attempt to end run that. This instruction should not have been given because there was no evidence to support it.
Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Harris, I have one more question. And again, sorry to impede your presentation, but issues have really got a concern to myself and perhaps the other justices as well. Talk about the comments made by Mr. Popovich, which are the subject of one of your arguments here. I'm curious, let's say for the sake of argument, we agreed that these comments are prejudicial and improper. Under Leochi versus Cohen, there's a protocol you have to follow in order to preserve that objection. Can you tell me about the timing? The statements were made. Tell me about the objection, how much time elapsed before the conference with the judge and the subsequent objection after the conference. Can you explain that timing to me on how that took place?
So if my understanding from the record is that there was an objection that was made shortly after the initial comments. There were other objections that were made at the closing of Mr. Popovich's entire statement, or excuse me, closing argument. The vast majority of the discussion was had at the closing of Mr. Popovich's argument. However, the objections once made should have been lodged and should have preserved that argument. These objections, once again, go to compound the fact that the video was allowed, the fact that the video was allowed to be replayed over and over again. The video was replayed by the majority of the defendants in their closing arguments, including Mr. Popovich, wherein he stated that this was Mr. Cox was only in it for a payoff, the green box at the end. These comments are patently improper. They are attorney misconduct under Leochi and its progeny. These, in and of themselves, should have been grounds for a new trial.
But you did not move for a mistrial then, as I understand it from the record, after in conjunction with the objections.
We did not move for a mistrial at that time. We moved for a mistrial as part of our post-trial motions relevant to the cumulative effect of all of these errors.
Okay, thank you.
Could you comment on the admonition that the judge gave the jury on Mr. Popovich's statement about the green box and the only in it for the money?
Yes. So the admonition in of itself was improper. We requested that the court give the specific admonition that attorney misconduct should not be allowed and that the comments were inappropriate and should not be regarded as something that the jury should consider. The court did not want to say anything about attorney misconduct or anything being improper and took a, I guess, lesser of the two evils admonishment approach. The admonishment that was given, however, did not meet the requirements in Leochi. The request that we made was directly from Leochi and the Gunderson case. The court refused to give it. Not only did the court refuse to give it in our post-trial motions, wherein we requested a new trial and requested findings of fact regarding the attorney misconduct, the district court did not make findings of fact. While it is true that this court can give weight to the district court's findings, it is impossible for this court to give weight to findings that aren't there. If the lower court doesn't give findings, this court can't give weight to them. Therefore, that in of itself and combined with the other errors would cause this court, I believe, to remand for a new trial.
Thank you. Ms. Harris, you have about 3 minutes and 13 seconds. Did you want to reserve that time for your rebuttal?
I would like to reserve that time.
Okay, well, what we'll do is we will give you, it's 3:07, we'll give you two additional minutes, so you have your 5 minutes. So you have a total of 5 minutes and 7 seconds. We'll add 2 minutes to the time of the respondents for their division as well. So thank you.
And
okay, I'll call upon, we got the clock set, we're all set. So Mr. Paulsenberg, we'll go ahead and start with you on behalf of the respondents.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. Dan Paulsenberg for Team Construction. Plaintiff is arguing cumulative effect, but this court has never said that cumulative effect is a factor in a civil case. You've got a number of opinions saying the court's never decided that. And I've even tried to get you to say it, and you haven't said it. So I don't think we can look at cumulative effect, but we can look at each of the issues. Let me first address the Sub Rosa videos. And you need to understand the bifurcation here to understand the issue. When we asked for a bifurcation, Judge Denton clearly did not want to go through a very long trial on both issues if it wouldn't be necessary. But plaintiff argued, no, we need to get into the medical issues because it would explain Mr. Cox's memory and how he's able to testify to it. So Judge Denton did something that probably was inspired by Verner versus Nevada Power, where the Supreme Court said where the two issues of liability and damages are intertwined, such as the plaintiff being able to explain why he doesn't remember anything, then bifurcation would not be appropriate. In a minute order, Judge Denton made clear that plaintiffs can go a little bit into his medical condition. And the judge, as Ms. Harris has explained, did give a jury instruction as well, talking about his medical condition. And he did talk about his medical condition. He talked about his pain. He talked about being assisted in walking outside the courtroom. So the issue clearly, it wasn't a total exclusion of any damages issue. But yeah, our objection or our answer to their objection at trial was absolutely right. This isn't going to his damages. It's going to his credibility. If he's going to, and we all know Judge Denton. So if Mr. Cox comes in at trial and exaggerates things to try to get sympathy, and we find out that we're being manipulated, then Judge Denton is going to feel like plaintiff pulled one over on the jury and on him. So he allowed that issue to come in, and credibility is not a collateral issue. Collateral issues are things that happen in conduct that's completely unrelated to the case or the litigation. Like if somebody had committed a crime in the past. And yes, they had the opportunity to explain this. Judge Denton told them that Mr. Cox can come up and rebuttal and explain why he seems to need assistance in the courtroom and yet doesn't outside the courtroom.
Well,
and
Mr.
so they
Cox,
had the opportunity.
Mr. Paulsenberg, if Mr. Cox could come up and explain, why couldn't their medical expert come up?
Well, first of all,
essentially that he's faking or exaggerating his injury and the way he's moving inside the courtroom or outside the courtroom. So why was it okay for Mr. Cox to explain that but not a medical expert at that point?
Well, first of all, because the judge didn't want to get into detailed medical testimony on and essentially break down the bifurcation. But I also don't think that issue is properly raised. because they didn't make a proffer of what it is or who the witness was going to be. And we all know from Landmark versus Moore that you have to explain your position well enough to give the judge the opportunity to do the right thing. If they'd come in and said, we're going to bring in Dr. Smith and he's going to say this, this, and this, then the issue is in front of the judge. But just saying we'd like to call a medical person instead of Mr. Cox, because they're making a strategic decision that they don't want Mr. Cox explaining his own abilities and disabilities, I think they've waived the issue under those circumstances. They admit it was a strategic decision not to call him. That's why they wanted a medical person, so that he wouldn't have to do it. And when you make strategic decisions under Cantorino, you have to live with them. So I don't think that rises to a reversible error. District judge has a lot of discretion to make evidentiary calls. And I think that is tied in with the bifurcation. They could have raised the issue and fully presented it. They only have a line or two where they say we'd like to have a medical expert. I don't think that's enough to present the issue to Judge Denton. Let me talk about the closing argument.
Mr. Before you move on, I have a question about the video.
Yes.
There's kind of two theories out there that you seem to be working on. One is that his courtroom performance, walking with the aid of the marshal to the bench or to the witness box, was a declaration that he needed that kind of assistance. Not articulated, but a declaration by conduct. And then secondly, there's the question and answers that your opposing colleague and Justice Stiglitz alluded to, where he's asked on cross-examination, the marshal helped you today. Did you ask him to help you? Do you need help from the marshal when you're not in the courtroom? That series of questions and answers. Focusing on the second, the series of question and answers and his answer, Do you need help elsewhere in the building? And the answer, yes, to be a sufficiently unequivocal assertion that the video becomes proper impeachment of that assertion.
Yes. But so I don't think I even need that. I think the assertion by conduct, and we have a section in the brief where we talk about Black's Law Dictionary, and it is clear to me that when a party is giving indications throughout the trial of disability in order to evoke an emotional response from the jury to help his case, I think that can be impeached. I think that is a form of communication. Now we put in our brief that, you know, he was even faking when he was under oath. I don't think I need that. I think the fact that the way they were trying to manipulate the jury itself was goes to credibility, and I think that the videos are admissible just for that. But I think the fact that he was asked about it and at other times talked about his physical state, I think that also makes it admissible. And I don't think it's reversible.
You didn't argue in district court, your client did not argue in district court that the cross-examination testimony about this licensed the admission of the video, did they?
I believe one of the parties did.
Okay. And if they did
No, excuse me. They raised it in the briefs. I don't remember it being raised in the district court.
And is that something then that we could consider?
Of course, because it upholds the judge's ruling. If we were trying to get the judge's ruling reversed and we didn't raise that, I think I would not be able to raise that argument.
Thank you.
And remember during the trial, they actually said they didn't want a mistrial. I don't think you can use the Leochi analysis to grant a new trial when they didn't want that remedy during trial. Again, a strategic decision that was made. The admonition, I think, was more than adequate. Again, Judge Denton probably didn't want to be rude and say, well, a certain lawyer committed misconduct, but he said everything else. He said, you know, that MGM had argued that Mr. Cox was just in it for a green box or for a payoff, but that's not an inappropriate argument. It's going to motivation and credibility. He's saying that, look, Mr. Cox was manipulating you because he wanted to get money. I don't think that's an inappropriate argument. Nonetheless, Judge Denton said you heard him say that, disregarded, there was an objection, and I sustained it. Do not consider it at all in your analysis. And that's all that Leochi requires. I think the mistake that plaintiff is making is confusing a part of Justice Hardesty's decision in Leochi, where he says you have to admonish the jury and admonish counsel. He doesn't say you have to admonish counsel in front of the jury. In fact, Justice Hardesty relies on Chief Justice Rose's dissent in De Jesus, where Chief Justice Rose says admonish the jury and instruct counsel. The admonition to counsel isn't you were a bad boy and you have to say it in front of the jury. It's to get that improper argument to stop. And that's why, and here you didn't even have to admonish counsel because Mr. Popovich had already finished his oral argument. So the only thing we had to say to the jury was disregard. And that would get me to the timing of the objection too. Here, first Mr. Popovich argued, and then he ended. And then there's a court conference. They raised two objections. Then there was lunch. We all came back from lunch. And then they objected to this. Now, is that a timely objection? Yeah. I'm a lot more liberal than most of you on what is a good objection. So they objected, but they got the admonition that was appropriate considering the timing of the argument. Also in Cantorino, Justice Maupin concurring said, there's not much you can't fix in a trial. So if you raise an objection, the reason we raise the objection is to let the judge do the right thing. And if you raise the objection, the judge can probably fix it. And I think Judge Denton did fix this. If there are no other questions, let me just go to a third point. When you get to the causation issue, where the jury found some defendants negligent but didn't cause the injury, that issue does not apply to my client, Team Construction, because the jury said we weren't negligent at all. And if there are no questions, thank you very much, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Paulsberg. Ms. Fresh, I believe you're next.
Good morning, Your Honors, and pardon me, it took me a moment to get myself off of mute.
Okay, no problem.
So, may it please the court, I'm here to discuss the appellant's argument concerning that the jury did not follow the instructions and that they manifestly disregarded the instructions when they found that MGM and, for sake of combination, I'm going to call David Copperfield's Disappearing Inc. and Mr. Copperfield as DCDI, just to kind of shorten it up here, for the two, or the three, I should say. It was clear from the evidence, for their burden to come up with this, they have to show that was impossible for this jury to find that MGM and DCDI were negligent but not the proximate cause of the injury. It is clear from this case that it was not impossible for the jury to find that. I would like to highlight, first of all, that with respect to one of the key issues that I think as we have to look at all of the instructions together, and one of the instructions looking back at this while I was preparing that wasn't really addressed by anyone in detail at all was instruction 31. And instruction 31 was relative to the ramp. There was testimony by our own expert that the ramp on the runaround for the illusion with these participants, in his opinion, was not per code, and that it was a little bit steeper than it should have been. And this is out around the corner of the theater building, actually as you start to head towards the doors to the casino by the cage. So at that point, our expert has said that this ramp was out of code. Now, the instruction was given to the jury that if the jury found that there was a violation of code, they would need to find MGM negligent as the landowner, as the premises. Now, that is evidence of negligence, but was that evidence that it caused Mr. Cox to trip and fall? No. And how does this relate to both MGM and DCDI? Well, there was testimony that ad nauseum about how this illusion was performed, how decisions were made, and how that route was determined. It was determined with a combination of the stage manager, the show producer, Mr. Kenner, and then it finally was decided by Mr. Copperfield. DCDI, as a corporate entity, is the contracting party with MGM for the production of the show, of the David Copperfield show. So essentially, the two entities are the contracting party, and it's with Mr. Copperfield, are the ones responsible for that route, which included going over this ramp that was, by our own expert, was out of code. So as a result, that would be something that a jury could find that these parties were negligent, but were not the proximate cause, because the evidence was very compelling by the two experts, by team, Dr. Yang and Dr. Baker, our expert, that this was the mechanism of the fall was a trip and fall. Contrary to Mr. Cox's testimony, this was not a slip and fall at the corner or when he was on the ramp. The security video, which is Exhibit 402, Clip 8, which we did move to provide to your honors for consideration with this appeal, that Clip 8 is very compelling as to where Mr. Cox fell. He fell over 15 feet from the edge of that ramp. The ramp has nothing to do with what happened to Mr. Cox. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry.
I mean, interrupt. Are you going to, because you're talking about instructions, now you're talking about the mechanics of the fall, are you going to be discussing the jury instruction on comparative negligence and whether that was appropriate, or is your co-counsel?
Actually, that was Mr. Russell was going to take the lead on
okay.
that. I'm asking a question. Okay. All right. So this is one example of the fact that there was a jury could find and did here, because I mean, we're hypothesizing always. What did the jury think was negligent? What did the jury, why did the jury find our clients negligent? And we're kind of second guessing, as we all know. But the standard is, was there substantial evidence that made it possible for this jury to find that we were negligent, but not the proximate cause? And I believe the testimony of the experts as to where the where the fall occurred, it demonstrates that that would be why they were negligent. And the fact that the jury took six parties here, the five defendants plus Mr. Cox, and they understood these jury instructions. They determined that three parties were negligent but not the proximate cause. two parties were not negligent. And one party, Mr. Cox, was in fact negligent in the proximate cause of his own injury. So the jury understood the jury instructions quite well. So, I want to leave some time for Mr. Russell to address the comparative fault. So unless there's further questions, that's it.
Okay. Or Mr. Thank you, Ms. Fresh. Is Mr. Russell next? I see Mr. Popovich online too. Who's going to go next?
Mr. Popovich is next, and I'll keep it brief unless your honors have questions. Good morning. And on behalf of MGM Grand Hotel, I am pleased to present to you on the issue of negligence versus proximate cause. I would only add to Ms. Fresh's statements that at the hearing on the motion for new trial, plaintiff's counsel, Deutsch, even argued at JA6505 that he conceded he saw a scenario in which the MGM could be found negligent but not proximate cause because of the negligence per se instruction 31 that said if you find they violated the building code, they are negligent. I argued that to the jury, indicating that if they found us negligent, they should still not find cause, because the fall happened so far away from the ramp that was the issue of the building code. Raised briefly, because it did not come up, but plaintiffs in their brief talk at length about intervening superseding cause. I believe that is only relevant if the jury finds that we were a cause or there is evidence to show we are a cause, and then the intervening superseding act would break that chain. You don't need to break a chain if there is no causation, and there is a lot of evidence showing that causation does not exist as to MGM. Counsel talked about Mr. Habersack, the MGM PMK that they called to trial, 30B6 witness. And in our briefs, we discuss just briefly here. He came onto the job long after this accident had occurred. He wasn't involved in investigating. We educated him to the extent we could. But plaintiff's position in this case is that MGM did a lousy job on the investigation. And yet they want to rely on Mr. Habersack's statement that he didn't have any information showing Mr. Cox having fault. I'm already past the 2 minutes. I want to turn it over to Mr. Russell, unless you have questions for him.
Well, I just want to be clear. So,
Justice Stiglitz, go ahead.
Wait, so we shouldn't rely on your own witness. Is that the position? Like, we gave you a witness who's supposed to be the person most knowledgeable, but he clearly wasn't, and we try to get him up to speed? Like, what's the position on that?
He was the person most knowledgeable regarding the extent of the investigation and the generation of an investigation report. He was not the person most knowledgeable on the legal evaluation of whether the plaintiff had comparative fault. He was never produced in that regard. It is not his job. I mean, essentially, they're asking for a lay opinion from someone who didn't have the full foundation.
Okay.
Thank you all.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Popovich. Mr. Russell, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. I will address the comparative fault issue. Comparative fault, as with negligence against the defendant, is almost always, except in very rare circumstances, a jury question. If you have a purely passive plaintiff, a minor, such as you did in the Buck case, where the plaintiff is not actively involved in the conduct and the activity, purely passive, maybe there's a basis to say there's no comparative fault argument. But here we are in a different situation. Okay? There was testimony from Mr. Cox that he was running hell for leather, that he had to run for his life, that he had to run as fast as he could. He was the last one in line. He was not looking at the ground, and he wanted to try to keep up with everyone and finish the illusion.
But Mr. Russell, isn't that all foreseeable? You have an event where you're trying to get people moving in the dark. You've got people with flashlights. You're hurrying them along to try to finish this illusion. Isn't it foreseeable that someone could trip or someone could accidentally fall? How is that not on the negligence end, and how is that comparative fault?
Well, your question, Your Honor, I believe you're asking how is it not foreseeable that those things, that setting up the illusion the way that it was set up, was foreseeable that someone might get injured. Well, you've hit on our exact point, which is that is a theory of negligence based on evidence. What counsel said earlier in her argument was that, well, this is a trip and a slip, and a trip or a slip is an inadvertent action. Well, as best I can tell, tripping or slipping is always an inadvertent action. There's never going to be an intentional trip or an intentional slip, yet there are countless myriad cases where comparative fault is at issue in a trip and fall and slip and fall. And in those cases, yes, there's an argument of foreseeability on behalf of the defendant, but there's comparative fault on behalf of the plaintiff in the way they conduct themselves. In other words, if you have a wet floor in the produce section of your grocery store, it is foreseeable that somebody might slip and fall. But even that foreseeability does not trump the fact that the plaintiff has to take reasonable care for their own actions. And if they see the water on the floor, they're not paying attention where they're going, they're rushing around the store, that is evidence to support an instruction. I think the issue we're running into here in appellant's position is they keep saying there's, quote, no evidence of negligence. Well, with all due respect, there's never evidence of negligence. There is evidence of conduct which supports a claim for negligence. There is evidence of conduct which supports a claim for comparative fault. Mr. Cox's testimony about running as fast as he could, running for his life, being the last one in line, was all contradicted by other evidence. It was contradicted by the evidence of the backstage employees who talked about the pace that the illusion is run at. There was a surveillance video.
But if he's not running for his life, that's all contradicted, then how is he comparatively negligent?
My point is if he is under the impression, if he is so wound up in the moment that he says, well, I'm running for my life, I can't see anything, I'm confused, I'm not looking at the ground, a jury could say, well, now wait a second, Mr. Cox, you volunteered to be in this illusion, you were asked if you could run, you could have stopped at any time. And there was actually testimony by the employees that they don't always get all of the volunteers to finish the illusion. Sometimes people step out because they want to step out. Sometimes they have to wait because participants do not keep the same pace. So there was testimony that Mr. Cox could have made a different decision in his conduct, and it would not have changed the illusion at all. It wouldn't have changed the performance. And so the jury was presented with that evidence. They were presented with evidence of his conduct. And the only question before the court is, was there a bona fide argument of comparative fault? And if so, under Verner and NRS 41.141, you have to give the instruction. Juries assess reasonableness. And it goes to what Mr. Popovich just said. Mr. Habersack's lay opinion, Mr. Copperfield's lay opinion, those are not controlling. I had a trial with Judge Corey.
Mr. Russell, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut it off here. I think you did answer Justice Stiglitz's questions. Justice Stiglitz, did you have any other questions for Mr. Russell?
I don't. Thank you, Chief.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we'll conclude your argument, Mr. Russell. Thank you so much. We ran over by about 4 minutes, so we'll add the 4 minutes more to Ms. For the appellants, Ms. Harris's time, so for rebuttal. Okay, Ms. Harris, you may proceed with your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to discuss substantial harm. Substantial harm is something that is very difficult to prove when you are trying to explain how a plaintiff has been substantially harmed by a particular error. And I'd like to discuss how substantially harmed plaintiff was by the multitude of things that happened here. First, the Sub Rosa video substantially harmed plaintiff by painting him in a light of a person who was manipulating and deceiving the court. And I would like to point out that this concept that he was deceiving and manipulating was an idea that was proposed by defendants. This was not a fact. These were not issues that should have been presented before the court and the jury. These were not issues that were a significant part of the case or were material to the case at that point. This was a liability portion of the case. What happened was...
Let me ask you this. If the case had not been bifurcated, let's assume that it wasn't bifurcated, you were trying liability and damages altogether, and you have the exact same scenario and testimony, would this video have been admissible?
Well, I think that creates a unique question because, first of all, the case was bifurcated, which immediately makes this a collateral issue. However, if it hadn't been bifurcated, I still believe that it's extrinsic evidence, and I believe that it is evidence that goes to something that is not part of the plaintiff's testimony. He didn't testify to anything relative to his abilities. He didn't give direct testimony regarding his abilities. Had we tried the damages as well, I imagine he may have produced those kinds of pieces of evidence. I mean, obviously, we would have presented medical experts. We would have presented medical documents. We would have presented witnesses. We would have had a lot of things. So, yes, I imagine perhaps it's possible that this information could have come into play, but it's impossible to know because at this juncture, bifurcation is being used as both a sword and a shield. We're not allowed to discuss damages, yet his physical condition is being brought up as an idea that needs to be discussed in court, yet we can't discuss it. So this therein lies the problem. It creates an impossible scenario for plaintiff to come back from. The Sabrosa video discussed information that was outside of the testimony that was given on direct. It was completely collateral to liability, and it should never have been presented to the jury. This goes directly into the attorney misconduct, which we've already discussed, and I won't go into at length. However, the attorney misconduct was supported by the fact that this video could be repeated over and over and over again and used as a platform for see what he did, see how he's deceiving you, see how he's manipulating you, which was a complete concept that was presented by the defendants. These were not facts. This was not evidence of his defendant's liability or non-liability. This was simply something that defendants didn't like the fact that he was walking with assistance. We could have, had we known that this was going to be about whether he needed help walking or not walking, or whether he had abilities beyond the scope of what he was testifying to on the stand, could have presented any number of videos or documents or experts regarding this. We didn't have that opportunity. The comparative negligence, as we discussed before, there was no evidence that he actually did anything outside of the control of what MGM and Mr. Copperfield and Backstage and the other defendants put together. Mr. Cox was following their directions. He was asked in the beginning, can he run? So there is immediately an assumption that he's going to have to run. It's counterintuitive that then he would be told later, well, you didn't really have to. He was told to run. He was asked to run. And he was following the instructions. If he had been looking at the ground, would it have been negligent for him not to be looking forward as to where he was going? If he were looking forward to where he is going, is it negligent for him not to be looking at the ground? I mean, to be slipping or tripping at a point where you're being told to run through a maze that is not of your construction, that is within the complete control and ownership of somebody else, and he had no foreknowledge of what he would or would not be doing, how can you say that he had knowledge of something ahead and then chose to do it anyway? He had no knowledge of where he was going. He was following their instructions. There was no
but
evidence.
But he had a choice. I mean, he could have said, I don't want to do this. I mean, he could have backed out of it. Your opposing colleague makes a point that, there's a free will in this on his part as well. that you need to care for yourself regardless of what others are encouraging you to do. And I'm not saying the evidence was terribly strong, but what does it take to get a comparative negligence instruction? And why isn't that present here?
So, Your Honor, what I'll say is that, yes, of course there is free will. However, he was placed in a scenario where he is within a situation that is controlled by MGM on their property, David Copperfield, in his show. There, he's a guest at this property. He's a guest at this show. There is a concept that whatever he's engaging in isn't going to be inherently dangerous. He hasn't engaged in something where he's immediately saying, yes, this is risky, and I'm assuming the risk. That's why we had this discussion pre-trial, and Judge Denton properly said, no, I'm not going to allow this assumption of the risk argument. It's improper. This comparative negligence discussion is just simply a way to try to end run that.
Ms. Harris?
There was no actual evidence that he did something unreasonable. Moving quickly in and of itself isn't necessarily unreasonable.
Yes, sir. The defense position of wrongdoing on behalf of the plaintiff is that he tripped over his own feet. Isn't that correct?
I believe so.
I mean, that's it, that he tripped during this, correct? That is the point.
That is the crux of their argument, yes.
Okay. And for instance, he says, I was running for my life, but there wasn't evidence that he lapped the participant in front of him or that anyone was telling him to slow down. The gravamen of the wrongdoing was that his wrongdoing is alleged that he tripped over his own feet. Is that correct?
Exactly correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Do you think that entitles someone to a comparison?
I do not believe that entitles someone to a comparative fault instruction. And I think to be able to have a comparative fault instruction, you need to be able to show that somebody, and it's evidenced in the case law that was discussed, that there was a danger that they should have or could have known about, that they saw, and that they took it anyway, stepping into the darkness when they knew that there was construction and that there's a hole there that they had already seen, seeing that there's a wet space on the floor and going and stepping into it anyway. These aren't the things that happened here, and nobody has presented any evidence that anything happened other than he slipped or tripped, and there isn't really, from a comparative fault standpoint, what is the difference between those two things? He hasn't done anything involuntary. There is no evidence that he was doing anything except following the instructions that were given to him. He wasn't doing anything unreasonable. He didn't go outside the bounds of what was asked of him. He wasn't doing anything too fast, too slow. In fact, there is evidence that he was being asked to hurry, hurry, hurry. In this situation, I don't see how there is evidence of comparative fault. I'd like to say that all of these substantial harms led to the ultimate inconsistent verdict. As I said in the beginning, it is difficult to show a substantial harm. But when you have a verdict this inconsistent, where you have negligence of three primary defendants and improper instructions given, improper videos that are allowed, improper attorney misconduct. We didn't even get to discuss the jury view, which we won't have time for now. However, we
Ms. Harris, excuse me, you're about 30 seconds over. I'm going to have to cut you off. I think we understand your position on all these issues. So I want to thank you. Thank your opposing counsel for the excellent arguments and briefs presented here today. At this time, the panel will take the case under submission and will be in recess until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.